Well, hello again, everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and I'd like to welcome you to the teleclass that our speaker has tantalizingly titled simply Influenza. It is a great honor to have you with us. About a year ago, I read an article on achieving optimal influenza vaccination rates among healthcare workers, authored by Dr. Monica Mehta and Dr. Charles Pastor, and I immediately recruited them right after reading the article for the 2009 teleclass series. It was a really interesting article, and I'm really pleased that we have Dr. Mehta with us to discuss it. Dr. Mehta received her doctorate in pharmacy from the University of Texas, and among her many accomplishments, she built and managed an anticoagulation clinic, which later won the Seton Healthcare Network's Gold Medal in Team Excellence for significantly improving patient care in her facility. Since 2003, Dr. Mehta has worked in New York as an assistant professor of pharmacy practice at Long Island University and at the Bronx Lebanon Hospital Center. She has a particular interest in infectious disease pharmacotherapy. I hope I got that word right.
Mm-hmm.
So it is my pleasure now to present Dr. Monica Mehta. Monica.
Thank you very much, Paul. Hi, everyone. Thanks for attending. Today I'll be talking about influenza. If you go to the second slide, you'll see my presentation objectives. First, I'll briefly review influenza, including history and epidemiology, the structure of the flu virus, a little bit of epidemiology, pathogenesis, and diagnosis of influenza. And then since I'm a pharmacist, I'll pay a little attention to the management of influenza with antiviral agents. But the real meat of the presentation will be the last bullet, which is to describe influenza vaccination, including the results of the study that Paul referred to. Next slide. Just a quick overview about seasonal influenza. Generally, it's caused by either type A or type B influenza. It's considered an acute, usually self-limited febrile illness. Outbreaks generally occur in the winter for various reasons, and rates are 10 to 40% over a very short time period of 5 to 6 weeks. Unfortunately, we still have a high mortality rate in the United States of 35,000 people per year. Mortality is generally due to pulmonary complications secondary to influenza. Clinical manifestations include fever, malaise, and cough. I'm sure most of you have had influenza at one point in your life and you could relate to it. Antiviral agents may reduce the severity and duration of influenza. However, by and large, vaccination is the best way to manage influenza and prevent it. Next slide. In terms of the history of influenza, it's a fascinating virus historically. It's been the cause of recurrent epidemics and worldwide pandemics every 1 to 3 years over the last 400 years. The greatest known pandemic occurred in 1819, in which there were three waves of influenza and over 20 million deaths worldwide. Again, a lot of these deaths were due to bacterial pneumonia that occurred secondary to influenza, and this is in the pre-antibiotic age. At present, influenza vaccination, use of antibiotics, and antiviral agents have decreased mortality significantly. However, we still have quite a few deaths. The next slide is a table of the history of influenza epidemics and pandemics. And I find one aspect of this table very interesting. First of all, there's a typo where it says 1918. It should be 1819. The 1819 flu affected multiple countries throughout the world, but it's fascinating if you look at the third column, which are deaths per 1,000. You see a significant variation from area to area. Most notably, in Alaska, there were up to 600 deaths per 1,000 population, where in New Zealand, 5.5. And a lot of people attribute the difference in death rates in different countries to be based on just general socioeconomic factors, access to health care, access to medicine, and overall hygiene. The last row is seasonal influenza. And in developed countries, there's a 0.03 to 0.3 rate of death per 1,000. Next slide. Also, in terms of epidemiology, there's a worldwide death rate of influenza of 250 to 500,000. Again, in the United States, there's an average of 35 to 36,000 deaths annually, and that has been found from 1990 to 1999. The vast majority of mortality occurs in the elderly, 90% if you're over 65, and the death rate is actually 16 times higher in patients who are over 85. So this is a key portion of the population that needs to be targeted. U.S. hospitalizations occur over 200,000 annually, and the rates of infection and hospitalization is highest among children. Overall infection rates with influenza have been increasing due to a growing population and a growing predominance of influenza A. Next slide. Mortality and morbidity. Well, influenza is known as a gateway to more serious ailments. It could cause COPD and asthma exacerbations. It could cause bacterial pneumonia or viral pneumonia, and a lot of that is the cause of death. Next slide. This is the influenza cell structure, and I'm not a biochemist, but there are two important pieces of the structure to keep in mind and bring up later, once again, when we're talking about antiviral agents, and those are the two receptors, first hemagglutinin and second neuraminidase. So keep those in mind as external receptors on the influenza cell. Next slide. There are three types of influenza, A, B, and C. The ones we hear about most often are A and B. Influenza C rarely causes infections, and when it does, it's relatively mild. Next slide. So we can't get around talking about influenza without going through the classification and nomenclature because it's relatively complex. So you see a picture in the bottom right, and that breaks it down in terms of how we name influenza. The first letter will be A, B, or C. A being, in this example, the virus type, so it's influenza A. The second entity is the geographic origin. So where was the area of initial isolation of the virus? In this example, it's Fujian. The third number is the strain number, which is an arbitrary number that we use to describe influenza strains. And the fourth is year of isolation. So this is influenza A that was originally derived from Fujian, strain number 411, that we saw first in 2002. Next slide. Influenza A virus are further subcategorized based on subtypes, and this is when the receptors come back into play. So there's either hemagglutinin or neuraminidase. All cell particles, viral particles, will have both of these receptors, but there are different subtypes for these receptors as well. Influenza A has 16 H subtypes and 9 N subtypes, and there's significant diversity among different virus types, and they differ in genes, structure, who they affect, also the species of host, epidemiology, and how it presents. So there's so much diversity in influenza, and that's been part of the problem in terms of how it's been a century-long disease that we've been battling with. Next slide. Antigenic drift. Antigenic variants will develop due to point mutations during influenza replication, and this in turn causes the frequent emergence of variants or antigenic drift, and this is the virologic basis for seasonal epidemics. It occurs more with influenza A than B, and this is exactly why we have to have an influenza vaccine that's distinct every single year because of the antigenic drift. Next slide is a little complicated, but it's a very interesting one. It's a graph from the CDC that essentially goes through on the x-axis what week number throughout the year of this seasonal influenza 2008-2009, and it breaks it down on the x-axis by what strain of influenza occurred during that time period. And the most important thing to make note here is if you look at the x-axis of number of 15, you'll see a very different color pattern left of it and on the right of it. On the left of it, you see a lot of dark blue, and that's the influenza A H1 subtype. To the right of it, there's a lot of orange, and that is the novel H1N1. So depending on what week of the year people contracted influenza, you see a different pattern emerge in terms of what strain it is. So for example, if someone comes into the hospital in week 25 with influenza, it's much more likely to be novel H1N1 than it is to be seasonal influenza. Next slide. Clinical manifestation. So what do these patients look like when they present with the flu? Symptoms are usually abrupt in onset, but vary considerably from person to person. Some people have very mild symptoms, and some people have very severe ones. It usually first manifests systemically. So you have fever, chills, headache, you don't want to eat, you just feel really, really bad, some muscle aches. And muscle aches for myalgias are, a lot of people use that as a key to differentiate influenza from other respiratory infections. Myalgias can occur in the back, the calf, even the eye muscles. And also patients may present with fever up to 104. And we consider the severity of the influenza based on how high the temperature gets. And these systemic symptoms may persist approximately 3 days, and then they may morph into respiratory symptoms, which include cough, congestion, discharge, etc. Next slide. We also always have to keep in mind when we think about influenza, who are the high-risk patients for developing complications? Which patients get influenza and do okay, and then which patients get influenza and have a high risk of death? Well, as I mentioned before, elderly patients have a high risk of seasonal influenza mortality. Also, patients with long-term health problems, asthma, renal disease, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or if they have muscle or nerve disorders. Another big population that may suffer are those with immune system deficits, for example, HIV or on chronic steroids. And also, pregnant women and children are particularly of concern as well. I'm not going to go into too much detail on the next slide of diagnosing influenza. It's going to vary from place to place, and I'm not a physician, but I will tell you that diagnostic tests are always combined with clinical suspicion. Here we have three main modalities, one being real-time PCR, which has the highest sensitivity. However, it takes time. It's used as a confirmatory test because it's so specific as well. Then you have immunofluorescence, which is fluorescent antibody staining, and this depends on your institution and the expertise of your microbiologist. And third is a rapid diagnosis. It's done immediately. You have the results in 30 minutes, however, has very low sensitivity. So any test that has a low sensitivity, you may have a lot of false negatives. So you have patients who come in, they look like they have influenza, you do a rapid diagnostic test, and it's negative. What are you going to do at this point? It always comes back to your clinical suspicion. Next slide, antiviral agents. So this is more my area because I'm a pharmacist. First, we have the neuraminidase inhibitors, oseltamivir, Tamiflu, which is a capsule taken orally, and zanamivir, Relenza, which is an inhaled medication. And we also have a little bit older medications, the amantadines, amantadine and remantadine. Next slide. Not everyone who comes into a hospital gets put on antiviral therapy because, like I said in the very beginning, influenza for most people is self-limiting. So who should be considered for antiviral therapy? Well, unvaccinated infants, patients with comorbidities that cause increase in morbidity and mortality, patients who are immunosuppressed, cancer patients, if they have metabolic diseases like diabetes, and the elderly, and definitely those who live in long-term care facilities. Next slide. So neuraminidase inhibitors are the primary agents that we use as antivirals. They should be initiated within 48 hours of the onset of the illness. That's when we see benefit. What benefits might we see? Well, they could decrease the duration of influenza by 1 day compared with placebo, but most clinicians don't find that to be a very clinically significant outcome of using these drugs. What is more significant? Well, they may prevent complications like pneumonia or exacerbation of chronic disease, and that's the area that you see most mortality. So therefore, these agents may decrease mortality. The data in terms of viral shedding while on antiviral agents is mixed. You can also use them prophylactically in patients who have high risk who were exposed to influenza. Like, for example, if their roommate was diagnosed with influenza and they have asthma, you may consider using antiviral agents. However, like all antimicrobials, we have to be very vigilant about their use because resistance is rapidly emerging. The next slide, neuraminidase inhibitor mechanism, is a cartoon that demonstrates the mechanism of action. Essentially, the neuraminidase inhibitor prevents the virion from being cleaved from the host cell, thereby halting viral replication. Next slide. The neuraminidase inhibitors are active against influenza A and B, and they're approved in adults and children. Next slide. I'm not going to go into all the pharmacokinetics because I'm not talking to predominantly pharmacists from what I have ascertained, but they're here for you to review. The essential difference is that zanamivir is an inhaled powder. It's deposited in the oropharynx, and it doesn't have much systemic absorption, where oseltamivir is an oral capsule, also comes as liquid, which is widely distributed in the body. Now, what about these older agents, amantadines? They have a slight difference in their mechanism of action. And they're inhibitory for A, but not B. And unfortunately, with a lot of cases of seasonal influenza, there's widespread resistance, particularly the H3N2 strain. Ramantadine is considered over amantadine because it has a better adverse drug reaction profile. Next slide. This just outlines the doses and difference in frequencies in the different antiviral agents, just for your reference. Next slide. Treatment duration can be from 5 to 14 days or even longer depending on the situation. Next slide. In terms of adverse effects of antiviral agents, with amantadines, one of the biggest limitations is the CNS side effects, which occur more in amantadine versus ramantadine. These include things like insomnia, anxiety, lightheadedness. Also, oseltamivir is relatively benign, but we have seen transient neuropsychiatric events like transient delirium, for example. One of the big issues with zanamivir is that because it's an inhaled medication, it could cause bronchospasm, so it's contraindicated in patients with underlying respiratory disease. All of these agents can cause GI symptoms like nausea and vomiting and diarrhea. So the next slide is a very important one, management of influenza antiviral resistance. You'll see that, so essentially the numbers in parentheses are the important numbers. This is the percent resistance. So for seasonal influenza A, H1N1, you have 99.5% resistance to oseltamivir, to Tamiflu. So Tamiflu was not active against seasonal influenza A during last year's flu season. But if you look at novel influenza A, H1N1, you'll see that oseltamivir has 0% resistance. However, if you scroll your eyes to the right, amantadines have 100% resistance to novel influenza H1N1. How do we apply this information? Well, we saw several slides ago that the predominant strain right now is novel H1N1. So if someone comes in with influenza right now, we're not going to use an amantadine. We'd be more likely to use oseltamivir, zanamivir. Next slide. Now on to the meat of the presentation, influenza vaccination. And I'm sure all of you agree, I'm preaching to the choir, that this is the most effective means to preventing influenza. This is something we don't want to rely on medications to treat. We want to rely on prevention. So vaccination is 70 to 90% effective in healthy adults less than 65 years old when the vaccine and virus are antigenically similar. And when they're dissimilar, it could be 50 to 77% effective. It's 90% effective in preventing influenza-related hospitalization. Next slide. There are numerous indications for influenza vaccine, including elderly people over 50. Healthcare workers, it's very critical that they get influenza vaccine. Also, residents of nursing home and other chronic care facilities. This is not a complete list. I urge you to go to the CDC website in order to get the full list. Next slide, other means of prevention. So there are other things that we can do, including isolate patients who we know have influenza, use negative pressure rooms, always for infection spread prevention, good hand and respiratory hygiene. These have been studied and shown to offer modest benefit, but they're really not sufficient in and of themselves. Influenza vaccination coupled with these things are critical. Next slide. According to the CDC of recommendations in 1981, all healthcare workers should be vaccinated with the influenza vaccine annually. The CDC has a goal to reduce transmission and staff illness and absenteeism, morbidity and mortality among high-risk persons. And Joint Commission says that influenza vaccine must be offered. It's controversial right now in terms of enforcement. And I'll talk about it a little bit later. New York State in particular has recently implemented a plan where all healthcare workers must be vaccinated. Next slide. What is the inactivated influenza vaccine? It's a sterile suspension prepared from influenza virus propagated in embryonated chicken eggs. And that's why if someone has a chicken or egg allergy, the influenza vaccination is contraindicated. It's standardized for every particular season because of antigenic drift. The 2009-2010 trivalent influenza vaccine, which, by the way, I received yesterday, contained these three strains. It always has a combination of influenza A and influenza B. And the dose is 0.5 mils in a prefilled syringe given intramuscularly, preferably in the deltoid. Next slide, pharmacology. The effectiveness of the influenza vaccine depends on various considerations, including age, immunocompetence. You may see less of immunity in patients who are very old if they have if they're not immunocompetent, and always, of course, the effectiveness for everyone is based on the degree of similarity between the vaccine and the virus. The majority develop high vaccination antibody titers, and these antibody titers are protective against the illness caused by strains similar to those in the vaccine. Next slide. Antibody against one virus type or subtype confers little or no protection against other viruses. Antibody to one antigenic variant may not protect against a new antigenic variant. So these are always caveats. In terms of contraindications, I won't read this out loud. The one that I want to point out that's important to keep in mind is that patients with egg and chicken allergies should not get the influenza vaccine. And if someone has active neurologic or febrile illness, the recommendation is to just postpone it until they're stable. In pregnant women, they should be vaccinated, but it's category C. Usually, we still vaccinate because the benefits outweigh the risks. The next slide just describes why Guillain-Barré syndrome is a consideration. In 1976, the swine influenza vaccine was associated with an increased frequency of GBS. However, we believe that the potential benefits still outweigh the estimated risks. Next slide. This comes from the manufacturer of a particular flu vaccine and compares adverse reactions between the vaccine and placebo. And of course, when you're getting an intramuscular vaccination, you're going to have localized pain. Last night, I had to take an ibuprofen because my arm was hurting. But other side effects like fatigue, headache, muscle ache, shivering, fever, they're very similar to placebo and not statistically significantly different. Next slide. Other adverse effects that we got from a study were compared with placebo. Respiratory tract infections occurred in 3.9% of the patients who got the flu vaccine and 2.6% of patients who got placebo, which is not very different. And you could see the same is true for the other side effects, that they're not I don't have p-values here, but they're not significantly higher in the patients that got the vaccine compared to placebo. Next slide. In terms of timing of the vaccine, influenza seasons will vary in timing and duration. So every year we have a slightly different range that we consider influenza season. More than 80% of U.S. outbreaks occurred in January or later. So even if someone hasn't gotten the flu shot yet and we're pushing December, they should still get it. They should get it any time during the influenza season. The vaccine should begin soon after the vaccine becomes available and can continue throughout the season. This year, vaccination has already started. Vaccination campaigns in institutions should be ideally begun in mid-October or even earlier, this year even earlier, and continue through December. Next slide. One of the keys in education to healthcare workers is that inactivated influenza vaccine contains killed virus and thus cannot produce signs or symptoms of influenza virus infection. And this is a rampant misconception among people who are trained in medicine, from people who work in labs to pharmacy to dietary to physicians. They think that they can get the virus from the influenza vaccine, and they simply cannot because it's inactivated. Next slide. Vaccination rates. Per the CDC, the average national vaccination rate in the United States for healthcare workers was just over 40% in 2003 and 42% in 2006. Individual institutions vary from 2%, which is remarkably low, to 60% in 2004. I work at Bronx Lebanon Hospital Center in New York City, and during the time we did our study, 2006 to 2007 influenza season, we had a 56.5% vaccination rate. Next slide. Vaccination goals. There's a national health objective of a goal of 60% immunization rate by 2010 to provide protective immunity. However, we need an 80% vaccination rate to confer herd immunity. For example, if we had 98% of the world getting a measles vaccination, we would potentially eradicate measles. Next slide. Factors influencing vaccination rate. Well, there's a lot of literature available on this. A study by Kimura showed that there was a statistically significant correlation between getting vaccinated and being vaccinated previously. People who get vaccinated, even if you talk them into it, are more likely to get vaccinated on subsequent years. Also, their motivation, understanding why they need to get vaccinated, is important. And knowledge and attitudes definitely play a role in the decision to get vaccinated. If there's a belief that vaccine is safe, valuable, and wise, it's correlated with accepting vaccine. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of media coverage in the last year against vaccination, and the medical community has been addressing that pretty comprehensively. Next slide. So what are some steps for institutions to increase vaccination rates? Having an educational campaign and formalized vaccine day. Strongly developed leadership roles, for example, having posters of the hospital administrators, medical directors, directors of divisions, getting their flu vaccine with a statement showing how important it is. Also, mobile vaccine carts to eliminate the need for people to leave their work area, take a break, and find something out, seek out a clinic, the clinic comes to them, and that has been shown to increase vaccination rates. Also, providing vaccination percentage to directors. If you're a director of a certain department and I were to come to you and say only 30% of your employees have gotten the influenza vaccine, that is very motivating for that director to increase their number because it becomes a goal for them and they know they're being monitored. Also, declination forms have been shown to be effective. So if I refuse the flu vaccine, I'm going to have to sign something saying, I know that I'm putting my patients at risk. I know that it's safe and I know that it's effective. However, I'm still declining it and I sign and date it. And that causes people to think a little bit more before they decline. So now the next slide introduces the paper that we published in Journal of Hospital Infection in 2008 entitled Achieving Optimal Influenza Vaccination Rates, a Survey-Based Study of Influenza Workers in an Urban Hospital. Next slide. The purpose of the survey is actually kind of interesting. During an employee health screening, many healthcare workers declined the influenza vaccine. They said things like, I don't believe in vaccines, or vaccine that made my friend very, very sick. And one person who is a nurse actually told us that he didn't want the flu vaccine because it may decrease spermatogenesis. So then we wondered, how pervasive are these beliefs? And we conducted the survey. Next slide. What did we hope to learn? Well, we wanted to know if there are certain groups of healthcare workers that refuse the vaccine over other groups. We wanted to know why they refuse. And we wanted to see if the refusal was linked to other factors, like where they work, how often they see patients, what is their understanding of the reason for vaccination, and what is their general knowledge of influenza and CDC recommendations. Next slide. Bronx-Lebanon Hospital Center is over 850 beds. It's a nonprofit community teaching medical center located in South Central Bronx in New York City, with a total of approximately 3,500 healthcare workers. Next slide. So our hypothesis was that influenza vaccine acceptance was linked with two parameters in particular. Number one, knowledge of influenza, and number two, motivation for getting vaccinated. Next slide. The first thing we did is we distributed a survey. We wanted to keep it relatively short so that that didn't become a deterrent, so time didn't become a deterrent. There were three categories of questions: general information about the employee, where they work, what is their job title, how often they see patients. Two, influenza vaccination, did they get vaccinated? If not, why not? And why do they think they should be vaccinated? And number three, what is their general knowledge of influenza vaccine and CDC recommendations? This is an IRB-approved survey. So it's next slide. It was cross-sectional design. We distributed and collected surveys by hand over 2 weeks, and we distributed it through different means. We went to meetings, grand rounds, went floor to floor to find nurses, and we went to departmental managers. Next slide. The survey, according to the IRB, it had to be purely optional. There had to be a statement saying that it would not affect their job, and it was 100% anonymous. Employees were offered a survey with very little explanation so that we didn't influence their answers. And there was a raffle with prizes, and that served two functions. Of course, to increase overall participation, and secondly, to decrease participation bias. Because whenever you're surveying people to see if they did something that is being advocated by the system, the people who did it are more likely to respond. We're hoping the raffle would bring out everyone to participate. Ultimately, we entered and analyzed the data in SPSS. Next slide. In terms of results, there are 570 surveys collected. The overall vaccination rate for this period was 56.5%. The top two reasons for not getting vaccinated included, number one, I feel like I don't need, and that was almost 32% of people who said no, and I am afraid of getting sick from the vaccine, and that is 23% of the people who said no. Next slide. So the survey, one of the limitations is that it doesn't have a good distribution in every single department. You could see that physicians were overrepresented. Nurses and technicians were well represented. There are certain groups that are very small. Pharmacists and dietary have very small percentages. However, there are also less of them in the hospital. Next slide. So in terms of percent vaccination by job position, 75% of all physicians surveyed were vaccinated. 67% of all pharmacists were vaccinated. And 65% of all people who worked in the dietary division were vaccinated, and you could see the subsequent numbers. The very last one was a group that we kind of consolidated with physical therapists, respiratory therapists, and nutritionists, and only 16% of those surveyed got the influenza vaccine. Next slide. So then we did statistics on job positions. what we found is that there was a statistically significant difference when comparing physicians versus non-physicians, in which physicians had a higher rate. There was a statistically significant difference between technicians and non-technicians, where non-technicians had a higher rate. And there was a statistically significant difference between therapists versus non-therapists, in which non-therapists had a higher rate. Next slide. In terms of rationale for not receiving vaccine, this was the area that I was particularly interested in because these are things that we could combat. Number one, I feel like I don't need it. And number two, I'm afraid of getting sick from the flu vaccine. Number three, other reasons. Number four, I do not believe in vaccinations, which is interesting that 10% of all the people that filled out the survey do not believe in vaccinations, and these are healthcare workers. 9% said, I'm afraid of getting the flu itself from the vaccine. 8% said they were not offered the vaccine. And only 6% of those surveyed said, I'm afraid of needles. And I was surprised at how low that percentage was. Next slide. So in terms of knowledge questions, again, we wanted to incorporate some knowledge questions so we could understand if they had a relationship with getting the vaccine. So these are the questions that we asked. We wanted to see if they could estimate the number of deaths that occur annually in the United States due to the flu. We wanted to understand if they knew what the CDC recommendations were. Next slide. So what did we find? There were three knowledge questions, and there was a statistically significant difference between those who were vaccinated and not vaccinated, in that those who were vaccinated had a higher average knowledge score of 2.35 over 3 correct versus those who were not vaccinated had 2.17 over 3 correct. So this was supports our hypothesis. Next slide. Interestingly, there was no relationship between getting all three knowledge questions correct and being vaccinated, and there are a lot of theories as far as why that could be. Next slide. So the other very important finding was that there was a motivation role. So in terms of the question, why are flu vaccines for healthcare workers encouraged, respondents were to pick one of these four, either to minimize sick days and lost productivity, B, because healthcare workers can get exposed to the flu by sick patients, C, because sick patients are exposed to the flu by healthcare workers, or D, to set an example to other workers. What did we find? Next slide. Healthcare workers who received the vaccination were three times more likely than those who did not receive the vaccination to indicate that the purpose of the flu vaccine is to protect patients. So those who thought that the purpose of the flu vaccine was to protect themselves or to minimize absenteeism were less likely to get the vaccine than those who knew that the purpose of the flu vaccine is to protect their patients. And this is something that we could really use as far as our marketing strategies for flu vaccine, because people who go into healthcare tend to be altruistic and tend to want to do that to help their patients. And this was a statistically significant finding. Next slide. So then we wanted to branch out a little bit and look at, well, what else is going on here? Are there additional players that are influencing people's decision of whether to be vaccinated or not? So we talked to managers. We wanted to assess whether managers were playing a role and if they had access in their department to a mobile cart. Next slide. And this is what we found. There's a lot of information on this table, so I'll just kind of go over the most important things. Look at physicians in green. They had a 75% vaccination cart. They had all three additional players. They got a mobile cart, their management was very involved, and they have a formal medical education. Pharmacists had two of the three. Dietary had two out of the three. All of those groups did reasonably well. Nursing as well had two out of the three. But if you look at the groups with the lowest vaccination rates, physical therapists, respiratory therapists, and laboratory technicians, they had only one or zero of these three additional players. Now, this wasn't as thorough of a study. This was just kind of an ad hoc analysis, so keep that in mind. But this also reinforces what other studies have said in terms of mobile cart and management involvement being important in influenza vaccination. Next slide. So what are some of our limitations? Like I mentioned before, it's a skewed representation of healthcare workers where we had physicians overrepresented. There was no or little data collected from night shifts and outpatient clinics. It'd be interesting to see how those healthcare workers deviated from what we found. Because it was a small survey, we only had two questions to test internal validity. It was possible for individuals to fill out more than one survey because they were trying to increase their likelihood of getting the raffle. Always with surveys, we make an assumption that what they write reflects truth. And last, there may have been other unknown factors like do they have a declination form play a role in whether they were vaccinated or not. So that's pretty much it for the influenza vaccination study that we did. But one thought that we had afterwards, if you go to the next slide, you can see live attenuated influenza vaccine. So there was a small percent of the population of healthcare workers who did not get the flu vaccine because they were averse to needles. And for those people, there is an alternative, albeit a more expensive one, which is FluMist. Unfortunately, this is a live attenuated virus, so it can cause mild symptoms related to influenza. It's administered intranasally, and it's approved only for healthy, non-pregnant people aged 2 to 49, including healthcare workers. Of course, if you're a healthcare worker taking care of bone marrow transplant patients, then it may be dangerous in that you could transmit the live attenuated virus to your immunocompromised patients, so that's when you don't want to use it. But it has some advantages in that it's a broad mucosal and systemic response that was seen in children, and it's easy to use and increased acceptability. Next slide. When we compare the trivalent inactivated influenza vaccine with FluMist, we can see several differences. One, most importantly, is that the vaccine is inactivated, where FluMist is live. Also, intramuscular versus intranasal. FluMist is also significantly more expensive, so this is an increased burden to the hospital or to the institution if healthcare workers were to choose this route. And trivalent vaccine is approved for anyone above 6 months, including those who are healthy or not healthy, where FluMist is only approved in healthy persons aged 2 to 49, again, because it's a live vaccine. In terms of efficacy, there's conflicting and limited data, and so we don't perceive a difference in efficacy between the two vaccinations right now. Next slide. So as I mentioned before, something very interesting is that in New York State this year, starting last month on 8/13/09, an emergency regulation went into effect requiring all personnel of healthcare settings to receive the seasonal influenza vaccine. And the purposes are twofold. One, to protect the health and safety of vulnerable patients, and two, to maintain a healthy workforce, to decrease absenteeism. Employees must be vaccinated by the end of November of each year. And unless they have a medical contraindication, like I said before, or if New York State determines that there is a shortage of flu vaccine. So the mandatory regulation applies to hospitals, diagnostic treatment centers, home health care agencies, long-term care, hospice, and there's a huge document that goes over specifically which personnel are recommended, but it's a very comprehensive list. First and foremost, it's personnel who have direct contact with patients whose activities are such that they pose a risk of transmission to vulnerable patients, and this list includes students and volunteers. Next slide. I just wanted to speak very quickly on the 2009 novel H1N1 influenza. So this emerged last year, and initially it was called swine flu because it was initially believed that many of the genes were similar to influenza that normally occurs in pigs. Most cases occur in people between the ages of 5 to 24 years old, and it's treated with antiviral agents, specifically neuraminidase inhibitors, because it's resistant to all amantadines. Of course, infection control and prevention practices are critical in all of these patients. Next slide. So where are we on the vaccine? The seasonal flu vaccine is unlikely to provide protection against novel H1N1. So pharmaceutical companies right now are in the process of producing a novel H1N1 vaccine that may be ready in the fall and should be given in addition to the seasonal vaccine. Next slide. So who should be getting this vaccine? Well, at first, there are certain populations that the CDC recommends get it initially, including pregnant women, household contacts and caregivers for children, very young children, healthcare workers, EMS personnel, all people 6 months to 24 years of age, because this was the population that had the highest morbidity and mortality, people aged 25 to 64 years old who have health conditions associated with risk like renal disease, asthma, COPD, diabetes, and current studies indicate that the risk for infection among persons 65 or greater is less versus younger age groups. This is directly opposite of what we're finding with seasonal influenza. So with that, I'd like to conclude and thank you for coming and open the floor for any questions that you have at this time.
Dr. Mehta, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I see you've left a great number of references there as well. Thank you for that. I had a question.
Sure.
I don't know if it was intentional or if it's just something that's practiced for you now, but I noticed that you use the word vaccine rather than the term flu shot. I read a very eloquent article some years ago now that advocated changing our terminology so that we don't talk about getting shot anymore. We talk about getting vaccinated. Was that intentional, or is that just the words that you use?
I tend to use the more, I guess, as an educator, I tend to use the type of terms like influenza vaccination as opposed to flu shot just by practice, because I don't like to be overly colloquial when I teach, and so maybe that has to do with it. But that's an interesting point. I wonder if flu shot has more of a negative connotation. Interestingly, with all the controversy surrounding vaccination, I wonder if we'll need to revert back to flu shot over vaccination, because some people just are developing a negative attitude towards vaccination in general, which is unfortunate. But
very interesting how the media and the terminology that we use influences what people do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also interested that the novel influenza vaccine is to be given in addition to seasonal vaccine.
Right.
So this is the first time that I've heard that.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting.
So that's going to be an additional one that should be coming out soon.
So is there capacity to make both vaccines?
So this is the big question, right? We don't know yet. And so that's why the CDC outlined who should get it first. The highest risk group should get it first. We're hoping that we do have sufficient supply, but we really don't know right now. I imagine there will be the capacity to cover the highest risk groups. And so many patients get influenza, and it's fleeting, and it's they feel bad, and they get over it. So with that in mind, I think it makes sense to target the high-risk groups first, definitely.
Right.
I just have a question with regards to the mandatory vaccination that I recently read about and that you presented in your very good presentation. How are the hospitals going to manage if healthcare workers refuse? What would be the consequences of refusing, or if you have a large group that refuse to the point where you're not able to care for your patients?
That's a great question. So to repeat the question, in terms of mandatory vaccination of healthcare workers and institutions, what are institutions planning to do for those that refuse the vaccination? Well, there has to be a good plan in place, of course, for what outcomes would occur if they refuse the flu vaccine. Some of the refusals are legitimate, like there are contraindications. I cannot take the flu vaccine. For example, if someone says, I cannot take the flu vaccine, I am allergic to eggs, what will you do at this point? Or if someone refuses the flu vaccine on religious purposes, and it's legally very difficult, if not impossible, to mandate it in those populations. So one thing that I have heard, which is a great idea, is that these individuals will need to wear a mask, a face mask, during influenza season, especially when in contact with patients so that they're not transmitting it. But hopefully we can get 80% of, if there's 80% vaccination rates, you could get herd immunity and decrease the risk of those who do not get vaccinated for religious or health reasons, decrease their risk of getting influenza as well.
Give us some information on what you tell pregnant healthcare workers.
In pregnancy, the vast majority of times, the benefit of vaccination outweighs the disadvantages of vaccination, and it is actually an indication for influenza vaccine. So healthcare workers should be vaccinated, and pregnant patients should be vaccinated. Definitely, if you fall in both of those groups, you should be vaccinated.
Well, I think what we'll do, you were very brave to leave your email address on both the title slide and the last of your slides before the references. So I think I might invite people to contact you by email, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Because with the background noise, and unfortunately we have so many people joining our teleclasses now, a question and answer period is almost impossible for most of them. Folk, if you do have a question, please feel free to contact our speaker directly. Dr. Mehta, thank you very much for a tremendous presentation. It's a lot of information, and I'm very pleased that you're able to make that time for us. Thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome.
And to all of our participants, thank you, and we will talk to you again very soon. Goodbye.